Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Hi there, everyone. It's 4 o'clock in New York. Today, President Biden is set to make a major announcement aimed at boosting vaccinations, which have failed to reach beyond those hardened political divisions in this country and now put the country at risk of a third surge that threatens the lives of the unvaccinated and a return to normal for everyone else. Enter the vaccine mandate debate in America. Now, President Biden is expected to announce a series of measures designed to boost those lagging vaccination rates once again, including expanding paid leave so that workers can make time to get vaccinated and then recover from any side effects. President Biden's also urging state and local governments to offer a major incentive to people who decide to get vaccinated now, $100 in their pockets when they go get the shot. Finally, the president setting an example that some in corporate America are already following, announcing this afternoon that all civilian federal employees will be asked to attest to the fact that they are fully vaccinated or face strict screening measures like regular testing, mask requirements, and restrictions on most travel. It comes as major companies, also hoping to stave off a third COVID wave, initiate their own vaccine mandates. Companies like Google, Netflix, Facebook, Morgan Stanley, and The Washington Post and Lyft are among the major corporations requiring their employees to show proof of vaccination. Restaurateur Danny Meyer is even taking the step of requiring indoor diners at his restaurants, not just his employees, to show proof of vaccination. And where vaccines aren't yet being required, we're seeing a return to many of the COVID restrictions that had become the new normal for us in the last year. Apple is reinstating its mask mandate, and vaccinated and unvaccinated customers at most of its stores will have to heed that. Companies like Twitter are shutting down their offices once again, just weeks after they reopened them for business. President Biden's declaration of independence from the virus earlier this summer is creating a bit of a political challenge for his administration as well. Washington Post describes it this way, quote, "This new landscape, and some say the administration's less than clear messaging, is complicating Biden's efforts to show that he is still leading the U.S. out of the pandemic, his presidency's central promise. And this time, he must do it after Americans have enjoyed a taste of normalcy and been assured, including by the president, that they had turned a corner." This week's developments mark the first significant retreat in public health guidance since Biden became president, and they set up a test of whether many Americans will agree to return to the tiresome protocols in place before the shots became widely available. But the shift has been thrust upon President Biden and his administration largely because of circumstances beyond their control, including a more contagious virus variant and an anti-vax movement that's fueled by disinformation and emboldened by Republican leaders and right-wing media beholden to Trump. As David Frum writes in The Atlantic, quote, "In the U.S., this pandemic could have been over by now, and certainly would have been by Labor Day if the pace of vaccination through the summer had been anything like the pace in April and May. The country would be nearing herd immunity. With most adults immunized, new and more infectious coronavirus variants would have nowhere to spread. Life could return to nearly normal." Experts list many reasons for the vaccine slump, but one big reason stands out: vaccine resistance among conservative, evangelical, and rural Americans. Pro-Trump America has decided that vaccine refusal is a statement of identity and a test of loyalty. The MAGA right as the most potent virus threatening public health and economic vitality is where we start today with some of our favorite reporters and friends. Jonathan Lemire is here, White House reporter for the AP. Also joining us, Dr. Vin Gupta, pulmonologist and global health policy expert. And David Plouffe is here, former Obama campaign manager, lucky for us, all three MSNBC contributors. Jonathan Lemire, I start with you. What is the latest on not just how we got here, but what the conversations look like inside this West Wing ahead of today's announcement?
Well, Nicole, we're going to be hearing from the president very soon, and he's going to unveil a number of new steps to really address head on the issue that we're seeing in the country right now, the surging coronavirus cases, particularly among the unvaccinated. And he is trying to set an example with the federal workforce. He's going to unveil new restrictions for federal workers. Those they need to attest whether or not they are vaccinated. And if they are not, they'll be subject to strict masking requirements, social distancing. Their ability to travel on the job will be limited. It is not to the point yet where they're mandating a vaccine for these workers, but it is certainly steps on the way to encourage them to get these inoculations. And they're hoping that the private sector follows suit. The White House has applauded and certainly said the companies are well within their right to require their employees to get vaccinations. We saw that the Department of Veteran Affairs is the first federal agency to adopt similar measures. The federal workforce writ large could follow suit, but at least not just yet. The White House also has directed the Department of Defense to explore how to add the COVID vaccine to its list of required inoculations. Obviously, there are a number of vaccines anyone who's going to serve in the U.S. military has to take. This is a step towards making the COVID-19 shot one of them. And the U.S. President Biden, when we hear from him in a few minutes, is going to encourage state and local officials to offer $100 payments to anyone who gets the shot. We've seen similar measures in some municipalities already. So this, Nicole, as in conclusion, is a moment here where they're trying to put everything they can, throw everything against the wall. They know this is a precarious moment, that as much as the president is reveling in this bipartisan infrastructure deal, he knows that the economic recovery and the nation's steps to returning to normal is all very fragile right now because of the potent threat posed by the Delta variant of the coronavirus. And this is the latest step in the White House trying to urge all Americans, particularly those so hesitant, to get their vaccines.
Dr. Gupta, I want to go. Jonathan took us through almost everything that they're announcing today. I want to take you through one more that is on the minds, I think, of parents. And I have pressed this White House for information most days about kids, because you are hearing more stories. But anecdotally, they maintain that something that David Leonhardt of the New York Times has written about, that the risk to young kids is still less than the risk of being in a pool or being in a car accident. But I want to read what they're announcing today for adolescents 12 and over. Today, the president will, in an effort to get more kids 12 and older vaccinated, call on school districts nationwide to host at least one pop-up vaccination clinic over the coming weeks. And the administration is directing pharmacies in the federal pharmacy program to prioritize this and to work with school districts across the country to host vaccination clinics at schools and colleges. In March, the Biden administration prioritized K through 12 educators, school staff, and child care workers for vaccinations. This directive worked. Today, almost 90% of educators and school staff are vaccinated. The president believes that every student, no matter their zip code, should have an easy and accessible way to get vaccinated. Vaccination is our leading public health strategy to end the COVID pandemic. Obviously, on the minds of people all across the political spectrum is back to school. And I wonder what your assessment is of this measure and of the risk to our kids in the school year.
Good afternoon, Nicole. I love it, because what we do know from both the private sector and public sector is that proximity, ideally on-site vaccination clinics, is vital to increasing uptake of the vaccine. I would like, and I'm hoping that we'll hear this from the Biden administration, he's talking, as Jonathan mentioned, he's talking about introducing friction. You don't get the vaccine, you're going to have to mask up and test. That's a great, great strategy. We know that helps with uptake. But we need direct engagement, Nicole. I think we've underestimated the willingness of those unvaccinated to get vaccinated if they have their questions addressed directly. I've seen it directly from folks back home in Ohio, for example, where you would think maybe there's rooted hesitancy. There is a lot of people willing to get the vaccine if they have their questions answered, which is why I'm skeptical, frankly, that incentives like cash payments are going to work. Because right now, the holdouts here have questions. They don't want $100. They have questions. And we need direct engagement from trusted, authentic messengers. We don't have enough of those. We need to find more docs, pharmacists, Nicole. So much of this depends on pharmacies giving allocation. We need to empower pharmacists, because a lot of people trust their pharmacists, frankly, and have more engagement with their pharmacists than with their medical provider.
Tell me what some of those questions are that you've answered and successfully put someone over the edge and convinced them to get vaccinated.
I think the biggest one, especially for young people, is this threat perception issue. It's so difficult. But for 18 months, you and I and others have had conversations about who is most vulnerable. And what we've implied, either directly or indirectly, is that it's mom and dad or grandma and grandpa who will end up seeing me and my colleagues and intensive care units across the country. That message has gotten very clearly to the teens and adolescents and young adults across the country. The threat perception issue is vital, which is why I think I've personally leaned into what my colleagues who tackled tobacco cessation as a pulmonologist have leaned into so successfully to target anti-smoking. Graphics, visualization, storytelling to make the threat clear that this is, and I know some folks don't like me saying this, but that this is COVID-21. This is not COVID-19. The assumptions of 2020 no longer apply if you're young and unvaccinated. So that's number one. Number two, I hear this frequently, this notion that if they've previously had COVID, they're safe. And we've had to, and this is where it's tricky because you get too technical, you lose people, but that the antibodies produced from the vaccine are different under the microscope and in the body than the antibodies produced from natural infection. Reaching people through storytelling, making them feel like you understand them, and then also kind of, you know, doing a fast follow with the science, I found to be effective.
I want to bring you in, David Plouffe, on this. I think it's sort of a loose narrative that there's some political peril here in the shifting messaging. I think that is only among people that are already detractors. I think most thinking people understand that there were assumptions made about people doing what they were asked to do, which is to talk to their doctors and go get vaccinated to protect themselves and to protect their families and communities. And I wonder what you make, if you could just give me your political assessment of where this moment of the pandemic fits into, you know, what is really sort of a hot war between the two sides of the disinformation divide.
Well, I very much agree with that, Nicole. I think Joe Biden, yes, he promised to lead us past the pandemic, but he also promises to be truthful and to take it seriously. So I do think communication is very important here, not just for the White House, but states and cities that are now bringing back mask mandates. You've got to start from the first chapter of the book and explain why we're here, why the Delta variant is different, and that we have so many unvaccinated people. So I do think it's fair to point out that while there are people who may have legitimate questions, they're basically merchants of death on Fox News every night who are keeping a lid on the number of vaccinations in these people. I think we've probably got roughly at least a third of the House Republicans still not vaccinated. So at the end of the day, I think you have to deal with the data and the truth, which is we got very close to stamping out the vaccine. Well, that's what the White House can say. But we're not there yet. We have a variant that's much more dangerous, and we have a higher percentage than we like of people who are unvaccinated. So I think you've got to throw everything you can at this. But I think you also have to point out why we are where we are, which is that's the tragedy. We could be literally weeks away from ending the pandemic here in the United States of America, and we're not. And again, there is active malice happening in the country. You've got all of these folks in the news media on the right, most of them anyway, too many elected officials with some notable exceptions. And there's no question that the Republicans who are stepping out now to be more aggressive about vaccinations. My guess is it's driven as much by sinking poll numbers than rising COVID numbers. But whatever the reason is, it's helpful. And we need to see more of that. So, I think at the end of the day, you've probably got 2/3 to 75% of the country who've done the right thing here, just want us to be done with the pandemic. And I think if Joe Biden and his administration are honest about where we are and why we're there and what we need to do to basically, we talk about last mile and transportation. We're potentially in the last mile here with the pandemic, but that last mile can be really tough.
Dr. Gupta, can I bring you in on that? Are we in the last mile of the pandemic?
This fourth surge is going to certainly into the fall, Nicole, as David points out. I think we're going to see some projections saying 800 to 1,000 deaths a day attributable to those zip codes that have vaccination rates of 40% or less. So we're in the last mile of the pandemic in most zip codes across the country, aside from the ones where there's going to be basically a bunch of Jasper, Missouris playing out come the fall winter. So in certain parts, yes, but in other parts, definitely not.
Can you, I understand our audience pretty well. I know their adherence to science, their trusting of medical advice, and they're primarily vaccinated. But I do hear anecdotal evidence that asking vaccinated Americans to put their masks back on doesn't just raise questions about the science among vaccinated people. There's a sense that the vaccinated folks have done their part. And so now the only people that are going to heed another public health warning are the vaccinated walking around in their masks. Can you just address all that?
I think that's a concern many of us in public health share, Nicole, and you really nailed it with that. The places that need to listen to CDC guidance that was issued recently are the places that are least vaccinated, where the governors like the governor of Florida, Arkansas, North Carolina, Montana have expressly prohibited mask mandates, for example, in schools. So there is a divide here, which is why, while this is important and while we need to, as David mentioned, explain to people why the Delta variant is a different threat, especially to young, unvaccinated individuals who do not who are not understanding or appreciating the threat perception. I think we need to recognize here that we need to double down on engagement here, that going back and saying masking is
We're gonna fix Dr. Gupta's audio feed and come back on this point. I want to show you something, Jonathan Lemire, that had to be very welcome by this White House. This is Danny Meyer this morning on not just vaccine mandates for his workforce, but for diners, for his customers. Watch.
This is the most logical thing I've ever seen. I'm not a scientist, but I know how to read data. And what I see is that this is a crisis of people who have not been vaccinated. And I feel a strong responsibility on our part as business leaders to take care of our team and our guests. And that's what we're doing.
How much of this does the White House think they desperately need to avoid a third or whatever surge number we're on of COVID in the fall?
Yeah, the White House is deeply heartened by remarks like that. They want the onus to be on the private sector, restaurants, business owners, whatever it may be, to say that not only do the people who work here vaccinated, but in this case, people who are dining here should be vaccinated. They know this is a very, very tricky political situation, the idea of a mandating the vaccines. The White House has made pretty clear, at least to this point, despite some critics from the left to say that they should do so, that they're not going to mandate vaccines. They're simply not, even today. They're not yet taking that step with all federal workers, although that's certainly not something that is ruled out for down the road. They would much rather have the onus be on the private sector, and they want the federal government to set a good example for others to follow, which in this case, Mr. Myers is doing so. But it does come at a precarious time. I mean, just this afternoon, Washington, D.C., home of the White House, of course, announced, the mayor there announced that the mask mandates would be returning for people to be inside, whether you're vaccinated or not. Anyone over the age of two has to wear a mask indoors now, which, of course, could impact the economy there in the District of Columbia. And, you know, similar measures could happen overseas or throughout the nation. And that's something that does worry this White House, because it's a two-part crisis here. It's obviously, first and foremost, a health one, but it's also an economic one. You know, certainly there was robust growth reported today, though it didn't quite meet expectations. But the economy is showing positive signs, but there's already worries that the next quarter won't be as strong because of what the Delta variant poses and worries about inflation and so on. And this is a White House controlled by a party that has very slim margins in Congress next year, and the midterms will be here before we know it.
David Plouffe, I'm going to put you on the spot. Are we too broken? Are our politics too dumbed down to beat the coronavirus pandemic?
Certainly seems that way. Yeah, I'm really tired of the stupid. I'm sure you are as well, Nicole, on a whole bunch of issues. And I think the point, by the way, you made about vaccinated people being really not pumped to go back to mask wearing and these other measures because of unvaccinated, I think it's real. I think most people will do it grudgingly. But I think the other thing, I think it's the selfishness here that really strikes me. You know, when you don't get vaccinated, and the people who really need to pay a price for this is the people who probably are vaccinated themselves, all their families are vaccinated, but they're out there screaming that people don't need to get vaccinated, we shouldn't wear masks. But again, these merchants of death, you know, in Fox News primetime and many others. You're putting kids under 12 at risk. You're putting the immunocompromised at risk. You're putting doctors and nurses who have been heroic for over a year and a half now at risk. The selfishness is really remarkable. You're putting our nation's economy at risk. And we're one of the few countries in the world where there's enough vaccines for everyone. And they're free and they're available. To Dr. Gupta's point, we need to do as good a job as we can to get them in communities. But in most communities, there's not a lot of friction to get them. So that's what's remarkable here. So some of that is stupidity. Some of that is selfishness. Some of it's playing to a very narrow slice of America that drives Republican primary politics. But whatever it is, whether it's getting on the other side of the pandemic, strengthening the economy, saving our democracy, yeah, there's days you wonder, are we capable of doing this? It's deeply disturbing.
Yeah, I mean, Dr. Gupta, I think this is the question. You know, can we do something this difficult? And I wonder, from a scientific perspective, do you think we can?
Well, you know, Nicole, throughout 2020, we messaged, frankly, on anxiety and the unknown, uncertainty, and frankly, fear of the pandemic. And I think we need to now message and pivot to the hope that we see. I mean, I see a really hopeful situation, but when I listen to news headlines, I don't get that message. And so if I'm unvaccinated, I wonder for the unvaccinated out there, what message do they get when the CDC goes back and makes this pivot? When the CDC defines at-risk counties as though based purely on test positivity from COVID or case rates, that made sense in 2020. And I'm not criticizing them entirely, but I do think we need to acknowledge the impact that vaccines have had when we're building in this risk paradigm. A lot of places might have increasing test positivity, Nicole, due to COVID-19, because few people are testing. They're only testing if they're symptomatic, and yet their vaccine rates are great. Their hospitalization rates are low. So we need to narrow the definition of risk. I think we need a message on hope. And we also need to be clear that breakthrough infections from Delta are rare, especially mild or any type of symptomatic illness. So people recognize that there's hope here, that we aren't back to day zero.
Let me follow up on that, because the breakthrough infections are rare. There's a piece I was going to read from a former Bush speechwriter about how you're more likely to die by a lightning strike than COVID if you're vaccinated. And I wonder if you can just explain then why we're going back to the mask mandates. Is that, again, a step that's more about transmission?
It is. And I think a lot of this data is not public. So Dr. Fauci and Dr. Walensky 48 hours ago essentially said there can be the instance, however rare, that if you're fully vaccinated, otherwise healthy, Nicole, you might have enough virus in your nose, as much virus in your nose as someone who's unvaccinated and who's exposed to infect with the Delta variant. That was concerning when they said it. There was no frequency attached to it, so we don't know how much of a problem that is. But based on prior learnings from the Alpha variant out of the first rose in the United Kingdom, it cannot be that much more. The magnitude's probably 1.5 times, 2 times at most in terms of transmissibility based on the data we do have. So yes, the Delta variant is going to be more transmissible. Yes, there will be more vaccine breakthrough cases universally, especially if you're otherwise healthy. These are extremely rare, mild to asymptomatic, and we need to be better able to communicate to the masses relative risk, Nicole. You had mentioned the risk of breakthrough illness from the Delta variant if you're fully vaccinated. That risk that it poses to that individual is hundredsfold less than they would otherwise be at risk if they just hop into the car and drive down the street. So we need to keep that relative risk paradigm in mind and communicate that clearly to people so we all have hope.
All right, Jonathan, Dr. Gupta, we were going to sneak in a break. Let me tell you all what's happening. We got a 2-minute warning that President Biden's speech, where he's going to announce this need for all federal employees to attest to their vaccination status, is just 2 minutes from getting underway. I want to bring you back in, Jonathan Lemire, and ask you about what is clearly a very complicated two sides of the coin message. They have to, you know, thread the needle in such a precise way to sort of keep the people that have done everything they've been asked to do. They've worn masks. They've stayed home. They've offered remote school. They've done remote learning. They're now being asked to put their masks back on, but to also sell the vaccine as our gateway to a post-pandemic America. What went into this speech today, Jonathan?
You described it right, Nicole, in terms of threading the needle. And we're going to hear from the president in just a moment, so I'll be brief. But yes, they don't want to alienate the people who have done the right thing, who have followed the science, who have done what they've been asked to do in terms of masks and social distancing and vaccinations and taking care of their kids. But they're also still imploring desperately the people who have not taken the vaccine to do so, many of whom are people who are politically opposed to Joe Biden and have made this part of their identity. Yes, it's young people who perhaps don't think they need it. They do. But it's also a lot of Republicans who don't want to do this because Joe Biden is saying they should. And that's a very difficult way. And they're trying to empower local leaders to encourage people to take the vaccine. They're trying to take measures on the community grassroots level to do so. At the same time, they have to be mindful of the greater public health good, even if that requires asking Americans who have already done so much to do a little bit more to try to get through this together. And we hear from Biden all the time saying, don't ever bet against America. This is another moment where he's asking people to step up and be patient yet again.
David Plouffe, you alluded to Mitch McConnell's, you didn't say it, but I think this is what you're talking about. I'm going to ask you about this on the other side, because Mitch McConnell has had a real public pivot on his messaging. Let's listen to the president first.
Good afternoon. Today I want to talk to you about COVID-19. Maybe the best way to start is, in a significant part of the country, you wouldn't have to take one of these off. You don't have to put one on. like in my home state of Delaware, where I live in Newcastle County, where I was yesterday in Pennsylvania, because people got vaccinated. They got vaccinated. They don't need a mask when the vast majority of people got vaccinated. Look, I want to talk about what's really happening, what it means, what it doesn't mean, and what we need to do this week and the months ahead. From the moment I was elected, I said I'd always give it to you straight from the shoulder. And we need some straight talk right now. Because there's a lot of fear and misinformation in the country. And we need to cut through it with facts, with science, with the truth. So, what's really happening today? After months and months of cases going down, we're seeing a spike in COVID cases. They're going up. Why? Because of this new form, this new variant called the Delta variant. This is a much different variant than the one we dealt with previously. It's highly transmissible and it's causing a new wave of cases in those who are not vaccinated. Our experts tell me that cases will go up further before they start to come back down. But while cases are on the rise, we're not likely to see, according to experts, a comparable rise in hospitalizations or deaths in most areas of the country. So you have to ask yourself, why is that? Because 164 million Americans are fully vaccinated, including 80% of the most vulnerable, our seniors. So there's a challenge, as you knew there could be. But there's also good news. We've spent the last 6 months preparing for this possibility. The vaccines are highly effective. We have enough vaccine for everyone to get vaccinated. And thanks to the American Rescue Plan and the hard work of the American people, we've administered over 325 million vaccinations doses in the past 6 months. We have the tools to prevent this new wave of COVID from shutting down our businesses, our schools, our society, as we saw happen last year. I've said from the beginning that we will be guided by the science. So here's what the science tells us. On Tuesday, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, announced its new mask recommendation in parts of the country where COVID cases are substantially high, where people didn't get vaccinated, which they define as 50 new cases for every 100,000 people in a week. The CDC recommends you wear a mask when you're in public and indoors, like work or in a grocery store. That's true for both the vaccinated and the unvaccinated. Why? Because even if you've been fully vaccinated and protected from severe illness from COVID-19, you could have the Delta variant in your system and spread it to someone who isn't vaccinated. We need to wear a mask to protect each other and to stop the rapid spread of this virus as we work to get more people vaccinated. And I hope all Americans who live in areas with substantial or high case rates will follow the mask guidance that's being laid down by the CDC. I certainly will, and I have, because this is one of those areas in Washington. And at my decision, my direction, all federal personnel and visitors to federal buildings will have to do the same thing. As I said from the beginning, a mask is not a political statement. It's about protecting yourself and protecting others. Masking is one defense against the spread of COVID-19. But make no mistake, vaccines are the best defense against you getting severely ill from COVID-19. The very best defense. And you want to know how we put this virus behind us? Well, I'll tell you how. We need to get more people vaccinated. Look, and it's important to understand what vaccines do and what they don't do. Put simply, the vaccines are designed to save lives and prevent severe illness. They're highly effective at both. 190 million Americans have had at least one shot. Of that group, about 90% are done now, and 10% are waiting for the second shot. To those folks who have one shot, but not the second, go get the second shot. Even if you're overdue for the second shot, it's not too late. Go get the second shot now, now. The bottom line is, if you're fully vaccinated, you're highly protected from COVID-19. But I also know that many of you who are vaccinated are concerned about what's called breakthrough cases. Yes, some fully vaccinated people will still test positive, and some will show some symptoms of COVID-19. That's expected with almost every vaccine there is for other diseases. But breakthrough cases remain rare, and almost all are mild cases. In fact, virtually all hospitalizations and deaths are among the unvaccinated. I also know many of you are wondering if you need a booster shot to add another layer of protection. As of now, my medical advisors say the answer is no. No American needs a booster now. But if the science tells us there's a need for boosters, then that's something we'll do. And we have purchased the supply, all the supply we need to be ready if that was called for. Folks, the truth is, as more people get vaccinated, we are better protected as a nation to continue reopening safely and responsibly. We are not fully out of the woods yet, because what is happening in America right now is a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Let me say that again. It's a pandemic of the unvaccinated. There are about 90 million Americans who are eligible to get the shot, but haven't gotten it yet. As I just mentioned, nearly all of the cases, hospitalizations, and deaths due to COVID-19 today are from unvaccinated people. Last month, a study showed that over 99% of COVID-19 deaths have been among the unvaccinated. 99%. This is an American tragedy. People are dying and will die who don't have to die. If you're out there unvaccinated, you don't have to die. Read the news. You'll see stories about unvaccinated patients in hospitals. As they're lying in bed dying from COVID-19, they're asking, "Doc, can I get the vaccine?" And the doctors have to say, "Sorry, it's too late." Right now, too many people are dying or watching someone they love dying and saying, "If I just got vaccinated, if I just." It's heartbreaking. And it's complicated even more because it's preventable. America's divided between the majority of eligible people who are vaccinated and those who are not. And I understand that many of you in the majority are frustrated with the consequences of the failure of the minority to get vaccinated. But I want you to know, I'm going to continue to do everything I can to encourage the unvaccinated to get vaccinated. That includes addressing hesitancy and misinformation head on. For example, I know some of you who are unvaccinated think the development of a vaccine was rushed, therefore I'm not going to take a chance. As a result, I think it's not safe because it was rushed. I understand. But let me explain. Our top scientists, the National Institute of Health, the NIH, and across the country, got to work applying decades of research, let me repeat that, decades that had already been done, the research, to develop the COVID-19 vaccine when it hit. In the last 6 months, more than 325 million doses of the vaccine have been administered in the United States, and billions of doses administered around the world. The vaccine was developed and authorized under a Republican administration, and it's been distributed and administered under a Democratic administration. The vaccines are safe, highly effective. There's nothing political about them. Look at all the people who took a shot at it. They later, we learned a lot of them had already been vaccinated. From the start, I have to compliment Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. He had made it political. He's encouraged people to get vaccinated and continuing to do so. And his state's in pretty good shape. Alabama Republican Governor Kay Ivey recently spoke out to encourage vaccination. And even the commentators on facts who have been belittling this for a long time, some haven't, but many have, are arguing get vaccinated. Look, this is not about red states and blue states. It's literally about life and death. It's about life and death. That's what it's about. You know, and I know people talk about freedom, but I learned growing up in school and my parents, with freedom comes responsibility. Your decision to be unvaccinated impacts someone else. Unvaccinated people spread the virus. They get sick and fill up our hospitals. And that means if someone else has a heart attack or breaks a hip, there may not be a hospital bed for them. If you're unvaccinated, you put your doctor and nurses at risk. The same frontline essential workers who put their lives on the line over the past year and have gone through hell. Again, with freedom comes responsibility. So please, exercise responsible judgment. Get vaccinated for yourself, for the people you love, for your country. I'm being literal when I say this. As I travel the world almost every day, a foreign leader calls me asking, can I provide his or her country more vaccines? Their people are desperate for vaccines. I'm doing everything to answer those calls. We're sending millions of vaccines to people around the world. But folks, it's an American blessing that we have vaccines for each and every American. We've made it our first and top priority to have available vaccines for every eligible American, and that's never going to change as long as I'm here. And it's a shame. It's just such a shame to squander that blessing. That's why after 6 months of extraordinary work and effort, today I'm laying out additional steps we should be taking to deliver these life-saving vaccines to more Americans. First, we're going to provide more incentives to encourage unvaccinated Americans to get vaccinated. That starts with paid leave to get the shot. We're still hearing that people are unable to get time off from their employer to get vaccinated. Well, this is unacceptable. For some time now, I've said you should be able to get the shot and still get paid. Thanks to the American Rescue Plan, the federal government is fully reimbursing any small or medium-sized business that provides workers with paid time off to get vaccinated. Employers, this costs you nothing. If you haven't given employees paid time off, do it now, please. Today, I'm announcing we're taking this a step further. The federal government will now reimburse those employers to give their staffs who give their staffs time off, not only to get themselves vaccinated, but also to get their family members vaccinated. That means employers can get reimbursed if they give parents time off with paid time, paid leave, to take their kids or their own parents to get vaccinated. So I'm calling on all employees across the country to give paid time off to get the shot or to help a family member do so. I promise you, it will cost you, the employer, nothing. You'll be reimbursed. Secondly, I'm announcing that we'll continue the work with, to work with states to encourage unvaccinated people to get vaccinated. In February, the grocery store chain Kroger's offered $100 to their associates if they would get vaccinated. And it worked. Vaccination rates move up from 50% to 75% among their employees. States like New Mexico, Ohio, and Colorado are offering similar incentive programs that have helped increase vaccination rates. So today, I'm calling on all states and local governments to use funding they have received, including from the American Rescue Plan, to give $100 to anyone who gets fully vaccinated. I know the pain people who get vaccinated. It might sound unfair to folks who've gotten vaccinated already. But here's the deal. If incentives help us beat this virus, I believe we should use them. We all benefit if we can get more people vaccinated. But in addition to providing incentives to encourage vaccination, it's time to impose requirements on key groups to make sure they're vaccinated. Excuse me. Just this week, we took an important step to protect our veterans. Like many civilian hospital systems are doing, the Department of Veterans Affairs will now require COVID-19 vaccines for doctors and nurses and other healthcare workers who provide medical care for our veterans. We must do everything possible to protect our veterans from getting COVID when they come to get medical care they so richly earned serving their country. We owe them. Next, since many vaccinations are required for active duty military today, I'm asking the Defense Department to look into how and when they will add COVID-19 to the list of vaccinations our armed forces must get. Our men and women in uniform who protect this country from grave threats should be protected as much as possible from getting COVID-19. I think this is particularly important because our troops serve in places throughout the world. Many where vaccination rates are low and disease is prevalent. Next, every federal government employee will be asked to attest to their vaccination status. Anyone who does not attest or is not vaccinated will be required to mask no matter where they work, test one or two times a week to see if they've acquired COVID, socially distance, and generally will not be allowed to travel for work. Likewise, today, I'm directing my administration to take steps to apply similar standards to all federal contractors. If you want to do business with the federal government, get your workers vaccinated. Look at the Chamber of Commerce, representing tens of thousands of American businesses, the National Association of Manufacturers, the Business Roundtable, which comprises of the largest and biggest corporations in America. They're all applauding the actions the federal government is taking and urge them to follow suit. I also commend the National Football League, that has announced that if there are outbreaks among unvaccinated players and personnel, then the team risks forfeiting games. I urge other sport leagues at every level to take every step they can. Every day, more businesses are implementing their own vaccine mandates. The Justice Department has made it clear that it is legal to require COVID-19 vaccines. We all want our lives to get back to normal. And fully vaccinated workplaces will make that happen more quickly and more successfully. We all know that in our gut. With incentives and mandates, we can make a huge difference and save a lot of lives. I also want to speak to families with children in school. We can and we must open schools this fall, full time. It's better for our children's mental and emotional well-being, and we can't afford another year out of the classroom. Every school should be open. And we're giving them the tools to be able to do so safely. Even in those areas where they have a higher vaccination, they have a higher rate of COVID. Through the American Rescue Plan, we provided schools billions of dollars to implement safety measures, better ventilation, social distancing, and other measures. In March, when vaccinations were scarce, I prioritized teachers and school workers by utilizing our federal pharmacy program. Almost 90% of educators and school staff are now vaccinated. Additionally, the CDC has provided clear guidance on how all schools can safely protect the kids and bring them back to the classroom. Every student wear a mask. It's that simple. So we've funded safety measures in schools, we've vaccinated teachers and staff, and we can mask up our kids for further protection. But once again, There's one more thing we need to do. Get more adolescents, ages 12 and up, vaccinated now that they've been cleared. In the past week, the good news, we've seen the average number of 12 to 17-year-olds getting vaccinated go increase 22% per day. Today, I'm asking school districts to host one last pop-up vaccination clinic over the coming weeks for kids ages 12 and up. We're directing the federal pharmacy program to help make that happen. Parents, get your children vaccinated. You do it for so many other things right now. For kids under 12, if and when the vaccines are deemed safe for them, we'll be prepared to get the vaccines administered as quickly and as safely as possible. Look, and as we work to vaccinate more Americans, we're prepared for outbreaks in areas where there are unvaccinated people. My administration has made it clear to every governor that more federal resources are available to them. This includes deployment of surge teams composed of experts from the CDC and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the FEMA. We're going to continue to provide states with more testing, treatments, protective equipment, personnel, mobile vaccination clinics to stem the surge of the virus among the unvaccinated. The pictures of hospitals in several states overloaded with patients is unnecessary, avoidable, and tragic. You know, we'll help any health system overloaded and unable to cope with the spike in cases. We're ready to do that. Let me close with this. If you're at home and vaccinated, but anxious, or even angry, or if you're at home and unvaccinated, unbothered, and unconvinced, let's step back and see where we are. Just remember how we've emerged from a dark winter into a hopeful spring and summer. But really remember just how dark that winter was. Over 3,600 Americans were dying each and every day. And now, even with the surge among the unvaccinated, we're down to that 300 Americans a day. Significant. Millions of people are out of work, out of homes, out of hope, and going hungry. Remember those long lines? People in their automobiles waiting for a box of food to be put in their trunk? Experts and pundits said we couldn't get the vaccines. And even if we could get the vaccines, we couldn't get it in people's arms. We couldn't get them vaccinated. They predicted our economy would collapse. Remember how we stayed focused and how we went to work? In 6 months, we got 164 million Americans fully vaccinated. Because we vaccinated so many people, put in place so many safety measures, and got economic help to businesses and people most in need, our economy is recovering. More than 3 million Americans are back to work since I was sworn in. Faster job growth than any previous administration, any. We're experiencing the fastest economic growth in nearly four decades. The best in the world as of now. In fact, today's GDP numbers show that in the first half of the year, our economy grew faster than any point in nearly 40 years. Our economy grew more in 6 months than most Wall Street forecasters expected for the entire year before we implemented our plan. And just yesterday, we announced a bipartisan infrastructure deal that's going to continue this momentum over the long term by making the most significant investment to rebuild America in nearly a century. We still have to face many challenges. We still have a lot of work to do as we readjust to a post-pandemic economy. But we have the right plan. We're coming back. We just have to stay ahead of this virus. I know this is hard to hear. I know it's frustrating. I know it's exhausting to think we're still in this fight. And I know we hope this would be a simple, straightforward line without problems or new challenges. But that isn't real life. We're coming out of the worst public health crisis in 100 years. the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. As I told you before, I carry a card in my pocket. I hope I have it with me. I have a carry card in my pocket with a number of Americans dead from COVID-19. As of today, this morning, the total deaths in the United States were 609,441. Granted, the death rate per day is way down. It's down to 400 about dead. But that's more deaths than World War I, World War II, Vietnam, 9/11, Iraq, and Afghanistan wars combined. This is as tough as it gets. We're Americans. When we get knocked down, we get back up. That's who we are. That's what we do. That's why there's no nation on earth like us. And we're prepared like never before. We have the tools to save lives, to keep our economy growing and growing and going. After the past 6 months, following the science, we know we can dramatically lower the cases in this country. We can do this. We brought our economy back to life and we kept it going. We know we can send our kids back to school. We know we can beat this virus. We can do this. We all just have to do our part. My fellow Americans, this nation has never failed. We have come together as the United States of America. So I say to all those who are unvaccinated, please, please get vaccinated. And to the rest of America, this is no time to be despondent or let our guard down. We just need to finish the job with science, with facts, with the truth. And together as Americans, we're going to be able to beat this. May God bless you all, and may God protect our troops. Thank you.
Mr. President,
how long do you think it might be necessary to wear a mask, and at what point do you think people might have to have a booster shot?
I said in my talk, the booster shot is not needed now. It is possible that it'll be needed later. I don't know. The science hasn't dictated that yet. And the first part of your question?
I think people might have to wear a mask again.
Well, if you notice, a lot of places people don't have to wear masks. Let's get that straight. The places where people have gotten vaccinated, where we have a high vaccination rate, people do not have to wear masks at all. Like some of you were with me yesterday when I was up in Lehigh Valley. Didn't have to wear a mask there. Don't have to mask if you come home to Delaware with me. I know you love doing that. But you don't have to wear a mask. The places, people are probably going to have to wear masks in those communities where the high rate of unvaccinated stays high and they don't move. They don't move to getting vaccinated. But I think you're going to find the patience of businesses and the patience of a lot of other people running thin. Because the fact is, if you had high vaccination rates, we wouldn't be in this spot right now. Yes, sir.
Mr. President, will this set up an American workplace for federal workers and private sector that really is the vaccinated versus the unvaccinated? And is that a pressure you're trying to harness now?
Well, no, I'm not. Look, what I'm trying to do is keep people safe. I mean that sincerely. So, if in fact you're unvaccinated, you present a problem to yourself, to your family, and to those with whom you work. Because as pointed out, I was asked the question about why would people who have already been vaccinated get it? Well, you got anywhere from 2 to 3% on average. The last study done, that can still get COVID. They don't get very sick. They don't get hospitalized. It's not serious, but they can catch it. And the concern is they may be able to pass it on. And so that's all being studied right now. But it's important thing is if people are vaccinated, the transmission rate drops through the floor. And that's all we're trying to do. Yes.
Mr. President, thank you. Why not push for vaccine mandates in states, private companies, schools? Do you want to see those entities pass vaccine mandates?
Well, I'd like to see them continue to move in that direction. And that's why I pointed out. I had asked the Justice Department to determine whether that is they're able to do that legally. And they can. Local communities can do that. Local businesses can do that. It's still a question whether the federal government can mandate the whole country. I don't know that yet.
Mr. President, you said earlier this week that we are not headed back towards lockdowns. But if the science is evolving, how can you be so confident in that? We heard you say weeks ago that the virus was on, but Dr. Fauci has also indicated that we are headed in the wrong direction.
Well, you're literally correct on everything you said, but it doesn't come to the conclusion you're implying. It is clear that if everybody's vaccinated, the existing vaccines work to prevent death, serious illness, hospitalization. Okay? If tomorrow I could wave a wand and every American was vaccinated, then in fact, we'd be out of the woods. Now, can something else happen a year from now? Can there be a different virus? Can there be some? It's possible. But I'm talking about COVID and the existing variants that have come forward so far. So it makes it's a simple proposition. If you're vaccinated, you find yourself in a situation where you are highly unlikely, even if you somehow get the virus, very small percentage do, that you are not going to be hospitalized, you're not going to be on a ventilator, you're not going to be sick, but you could be in a position to possibly spread it to someone who wasn't if you have it in you. Yes.
Thank you so much, Mr. President. Thank you. I wanted to ask, why not require that the people show proof that they're vaccinated? And also, if you could just, with the 4 million, how much of an impact do you think this will have? Do you have a projection, sir?
A projection on what?
On how many people will get vaccinated by putting in this system?
No, I'm not going to get in the business of projecting. Exactly how many people are likely. All I know is that we go through these periods, then we run up against a wall, then something happens where people realize, oh my Lord, this is really a problem, and they begin to see things. Look, the fact that a lot of your friends are now saying, get vaccinated, who were before were saying, this is not a problem. This is all a Democratic thing with a small D and a capital D. I mean, there's a lot changing. People are becoming aware. The more aware they become, then we have these surges of people going out and getting vaccinated. And it just keeps building.
I'm sorry, sir.
What about what?
What about requiring proof, sir?
Well, there's two ways to do it. I think you're going to see some institutions doing that. Like you're going to fly abroad, you're going to have to have proof. You're not just going to be able to say, yeah, I got tested. You got to provide proof. My guess is if we don't start to make more progress, a lot of businesses and a lot of enterprises are going to require proof for you to be able to participate.
Mr. President.
And then I'm going to take off shortly here.
What further actions are you going to take to encourage private businesses to follow this type of model to either require vaccines or require testing or other preventative procedures?
I just did. I'm going to keep at it. I'm going to be talking about it around the country.
To reach out to private businesses, meet with them, try and actively encourage them to follow this model.
Well, I have. That's why we have folks from the Chamber of Commerce to the manufacturers, et cetera. So, you know, am I going to call a meeting of every, you know, business in the country to come to Washington or go on? I have made the case repeatedly. I doubt whether there's a single solitary business that doesn't understand that I think it's smart for them to require testing, and if you can't demonstrate, you can't prove you've been vaccinated, you have to be tested.
Said he was already considering mandating the vaccine after it was fully approved. Would you like to see the mandate go into effect before full approval? And do you think he's open to that?
I know he's open to it. And the question is, when is the right time to get the most bang for the buck when you do it? A lot of this is timing. And so I think it's going to happen. But I look, the one thing that you all are being politely and appropriately referencing is that it's still a temporary approval. So when does the final approval come? It usually takes a lot of work to get there. I made a commitment. I would not tell anyone in the Justice Department who they should prosecute, and I would not tell the health industry, the government health entities, what they should say and do. But my expectation is they're going to reach that conclusion in the early fall. Thank you very much.
It was a big speech from President Biden at a big and crucial moment in the country's fight against the coronavirus pandemic. Let's see. He's taking one more question here. Let's listen.
In an area where we do not have... Well, let me clarify.
In May, you made it sound like a vaccine was the ticket to losing the mask forever.
That is true at the time, because I thought there were people who were going to understand that getting vaccinated made a gigantic difference. And what happened was, new variant came along, they didn't get vaccinated, it was spread more rapidly, and more people were getting sick. That's the
difference. But vaccinated are you with those people, sir?
We're still listening and watching because questions are still being shouted. A round of questioning that kicked off with Steve Holland, followed by Kelly O'Donnell, the new chair of the White House Correspondents Association, turned into quite a Q&A with President Biden. The headlines there today, President Biden making clear that he had sought a legal opinion from DOJ about whether communities and businesses could require vaccinations. He says that has been clearly articulated by DOJ. The president today announcing that the federal workforce will be required to attest to their vaccination status. If they are not vaccinated, they will be asked to subject to rigorous testing, mask wearing, social distancing, and very limited travel will be permitted. President also there at the end getting some questions about the status of his Secretary of Defense, Secretary Austin, mandating vaccines at the Pentagon. He said he has asked him to look at that. Some questions there at the end, one that seemed to evoke some passions from this president about why the mask guidance in America changed for the vaccinated. President turning around and making very clear that this is a dynamic situation, that because the vaccination rates didn't reach a level that allowed us to stamp out COVID, the Delta variant is now surging among the unvaccinated. President notably singled out three Republicans and one sports league for praise, arguably because they perhaps reach people he can't. Mitch McConnell, Kay Ivey, the NFL, and some unnamed Fox News hosts for being pro-vaccine. Watching along with us, Jonathan Lemire, Dr. Vin Gupta, and David Plouffe. Jonathan Lemire, your thoughts.
Well, first of all, it was a passionate response from the president. And the line that stuck with me, Nicole, more than any other is he declared that an American tragedy, that people are dying who don't have to die. And he pointed a finger squarely at the unvaccinated, saying that they were the source of this surge we're seeing of the virus, that people, who many of them identify as Republican or conservative, or the young who don't think they need it, are putting themselves and others at risk for not getting vaccinated. And he's doing what he can. Right now, the federal government, as we were discussing before the president took to the podium, he is not mandating the federal workers receive the vaccine. That's a bridge that he and his team don't want to cross, at least not yet, although certainly they hinted that it could be in the future at the Pentagon before too long. We have seen it at the Department of Veterans Affairs, but he's doing everything he can to encourage people to do it, including making life, frankly, rather difficult for federal workers and contractors who haven't been vaccinated. They need to prove that if they can't prove that they are, they're going to have to be tested repeatedly with the idea that some of them will want to. He added incentives, $100 or so is what he encouraged state and local governments to pay people to get the shots. We heard him talk about asking the military to explore adding the COVID-19 vaccine to their list of required inoculations, and the list goes on. But more than that, it was an appeal appeal, frankly, to the American decency, to saying that, look, we have come this far together, but it's at risk. As much as he touted what his administration has done so far in terms of economic recovery, in terms of getting people vaccinated, he said there's a chance here for a slide backwards. And this is, let's be clear, Nicole, as a final point, the first time since this president took office that cases have gone up, that the news on the virus isn't good news. It's not steady progress. It is, as he said, not a straight line. And that's something that he is asking for patience from the American people and asking people to do their part. And that means getting the shot.
As if on cue, joining our conversation is White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain. Ron Klain, my first question for you is, the president was leaving the speech and the rather lengthy Q&A session afterward. There was a shouted question about Dr. Jill Biden. What was that about? His response was, I'm about to find out.
Dr. Biden, while she was in Hawaii, coming back from Japan for the Olympics, she made some stops there to encourage vaccination while she was out walking. She stepped on a sharp object, and so she's going to go to Walter Reed this afternoon and have that object removed.
Okay, we appreciate that, and we just caught our ear as he was almost out the door. I want to ask you about what the president made abundantly clear, that this is a tragedy, obviously, because we continue to have Americans sick and dying. But at this point, the vast majority of them, all of them, he said, are unvaccinated. How did you come to sort of this impassioned plea and calling out and singling out for praise people like Mitch McConnell and Kay Ivey and the NFL for their help? Is that where we are? Do you feel like this president has reached everyone he can convince?
No, look, I think that the president has consistently been reaching out to people to try to persuade them. But it's not just persuasion. Also provide incentives, make it easier for people to get vaccinated. Look, the most compelling thing, I think, is putting the vaccine within reach of the largest number of people. We've done that with 80,000 sites. It's free, obviously. You no longer need an appointment. You just walk in and get it any time. President talked about more incentives today, whether that's paid time off to get yourself vaccinated, get a family member vaccinated, giving people $100 to get vaccinated. And also, of course, putting some requirements on to try to encourage people to get vaccinated or else go through rigorous testing regimes and whatnot. So, we're going to use the full set of carrots and sticks we have here to try to make more progress. We have nearly 70% of people with one shot. We need to get the rest of the country vaccinated. That's what we've been trying all 6 months. That's what we're going to continue to do. Hopefully this new Delta variant will make people pay a little more attention and do what they need to do.
Does the president, we saw a flash of real passion there that he's having to explain that the mask guidance changing wasn't any sort of policy flip-flop. It was a dynamic nature of a vaccine. I mean, what is sort of the degree of exasperation with the power of disinformation on the right?
Well, I mean, obviously we are concerned about disinformation. And also we're trying hard to correct it with truthful information, with real information. You heard the president go through that today. The number one thing we hear from people who refuse the vaccine is this concern that it was developed too quickly. And the president again explained the scientific background and history of the vaccine. We hear people say that they're concerned about side effects. We've talked about that. And so we're combating disinformation with the truthful information, with scientific information, trying again to persuade more and more Americans to get vaccinated, to protect themselves, to protect their families, to protect their communities, keep our economy growing, all the things we all want to see happen.
Do you expect policy escalations? I mean, could you see calling on the sorts of things where you do have control to mandate vaccination, attestation to travel by air or train or any other way?
Well, I think we've laid out a set of incentives today. Obviously, we're always looking at additional policies. Hopefully, these things will get the job done. But I think that we laid out a very robust set of policy initiatives today, and we're hoping that continues to prod the American people to do what they need to do, get the rest of the country vaccinated.
Ron, were there conversations between, he singled out Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who has a very notable new, I believe his campaign fund is paying for PSAs or ads to advocate for the vaccine. Was that at this president's urging?
No, first of all, we need to give Senator McConnell credit. He has been encouraging Americans to get vaccinated since the vaccine was first authorized back in December. He has been a strong, consistent, regular voice urging vaccinations. And he and the president have discussed this previously months ago. And I just think Senator McConnell's been as strong urging vaccinations as any public figure has been.
Would you like to see him do more if that's the case?
Look, I would like to see us all do more. Senator McConnell has done, again, has done a lot more than a lot of other folks have. What I'd like to see is, you know, more and more people do this, more voices, you know, in both parties, reach out and encourage people to get vaccinated. But I think you know, we have our differences with Senator McConnell here, but his vigor in pushing vaccinations is not one of those differences. He's been a very strong advocate for this.
I know this isn't all that you work on. I have one more question. I mean, the president made clear to speak to what is on people's minds across the country, across the ideological spectrum. He made clear that schools will be open in the fall, unequivocally, that the safest way to do that is to keep vaccination levels in communities down so that kids under 12 who can't be vaccinated are at the lowest risk possible. Do you have any information about when kids younger than 12 will be eligible for the vaccine?
Nicole, I don't have any private information on that. You know, the medical community's discussed that the clinical trials are still going on. As you heard last week, two of the major vaccine makers expanded those clinical trials to make sure we're going to be safe in terms of side effects. As soon as those clinical trials are finished, the FDA, I know, will review the data quickly. I really wouldn't want to put a timeline on it. I've heard experts say later this fall, maybe November. But again, I don't have any private or inside information on that. That's just the public information about the progress of these clinical trials and potential FDA reviews.
Ron, let me get you on the record on the infrastructure deal. How involved were you? How involved was this president? And how important is this to the agenda?
Well, it's very important to the president's agenda. It's very important to the country. Look, we've been talking about Infrastructure Week for a long time. And we have bridges in this country that are cracked, that are unsafe. We have roads that need to be upgraded. We need to get every kid in this America broadband. We need to get all the lead pipes out of the ground and get every kid in America and every family in America safe drinking water, clean drinking water. And we need to build electric vehicle stations. We need to start to make investments to build the clean energy economy of the future, electric buses, all these things that are in this package. They're vital investments. I'm proud to be part of the team here, but the president really, you know, engaged directly with members of the House and the Senate, particularly members of the Senate. I met with Republicans, with Democrats, really pushed to get this done. Obviously, we're still at the first step. The bill is just now getting to the Senate floor. We got to get the bill passed. We got to get it over the House. We got a lot of work left to do. But I think this is a significant move to address the vital infrastructure needs. And yes, I do think it's positive that it is bipartisan. It shows that Democrats and Republicans can get together and start to tackle some of these problems. And I think that's also a hopeful element of this.
Ron, there's now a playbook for the successful legislative endeavors by this White House, the COVID relief package, which was not bipartisan. It was in terms of the support you had out in the country, and the president made that point repeatedly. And now the infrastructure deal, which, as you said, is bipartisan. Will either one of those approaches be applied to something that many Democrats and even some Republicans find urgent, and that is the need to protect the right to vote and the right to have your vote counted from 389 voter suppression laws racing through 48 states?
Yeah, Nicole, obviously voting rights is very important to this president. It's one of the reasons why he ran for president. I was encouraged to see yesterday progress in the Senate, conversations between Senator Warnock, Senator Manchin, Senator Globuchar, who's a great leader on this, Senator Schumer, of course. Hopefully they can come together on a package that we can start to move through the Senate.
White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain, whose desk every problem in this White House, in this country, lands. Thank you for spending some time to talk to us today. It's always nice to see you.
Thanks for having me, Nicole. I appreciate it.
Let me come back to our friends who've been watching all the day's news with us, Jonathan Lemire, Dr. Vin Gupta, and David Plouffe. Dr. Gupta, what did you hear today that you think might make a difference, either in a company sort of anxious about a vaccine mandate for their workforce, or someone out there who may not be part of that hardcore anti-vax, but may just be hesitant?
Well, a few things, Nicole. Thank you. President Biden focusing on paid leave, absolutely vital proximity, talking about making access within, say, 5 square miles of an individual. We know both of those things are vital. Also, just talked about misinformation. It's important for him at the podium to talk about that. Where I disagree is this notion that money incentives will move the needle. I think money has moved the needle at this point. It's not going to reach those who we haven't reached yet. He was also clear, Nicole, on what success looks like. You know, especially with pivoting CDC guidance, a lot of people wonder, what does success look like so I can hope? And it's pretty clear. You said lowering deaths and hospitalizations is what success looks like, not necessarily lowering case rates. And that's important because I'll just say President Biden noted two things that I just wanted to elaborate on. One, he said that he was in Philadelphia and he didn't need to wear a mask because he was in a highly vaccinated region. And just to elaborate on that, that's actually not what CDC put out. They said that in places where there's high transmission rates of COVID-19, you might be in a substantial or high risk area, you should consider masking up, not places that have high rates of vaccines. And that matters because that's been confusing to people, say in LA County or even here in Seattle, where we're recommended to wear masks, even though we have 70% adoption of the vaccine, COVID-related hospitalizations are low. That feels unclear to people. So he was clear on what success looks like. He even delineated that when he said why he didn't wear a mask in Philadelphia. But again, that was counter to what CDC put out. And then lastly, booster shots. He said that he doesn't have clarity on that right now. It is, and for all those people that are immunocompromised watching right now, it is pretty clear that we're going to need booster shots for those that are immunocompromised, cancer, recent chemotherapy. It's a long list, Nicole. But we will need those booster shots for that group based on studies that have come out. FDA, CDC is going to be updating their guidance shortly. But I just want to make sure that we clarify that booster shots will be needed for a select group of Americans.
No, it's important to have you underscoring we've all sort of become armchair epidemiologists trying to make the best decisions, throwing masks in the hands of our family members based on where we are. And it's really important and really helpful to have that clarity. David Love, I want to come to you on both the president and Ron Klain. This is a sort of eyes wide open White House. I mean, they understand the country. I had asked earlier in the week, tried to do some of my own reporting on whether the president thinks his optimism was misplaced. The president's calculation seems to be that we are, yes, still down, but we can get back up because that's what we do. So I think to answer the question you and I were batting around, can we do hard things? It is still this president's view and his chief of staff's view that we can. I wonder if you can sort of speak to the sort of singling out Mitch McConnell. Both Ron Klain and the president did that. They're obviously seeing some usefulness and some need to have allies on the other side of this sort of disinformation divide in this country.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the message may be we can still do hard things in this country, but we're making it harder than we should to do hard things. By the way, I think America's so fortunate to have Ron Klain in that chief of staff seat, given the variety of crises we have. But no, I think, listen, there are still, Democrats, handful of progressives maybe that are not vaccinated. But the data is pretty clear where most of the unvaccinated people lie ideologically. So I think to lift up, and Mitch McConnell has been from the very first day, just steadfast. He's been terrific on messages around vaccine. You're starting to see more Republican governors do that. You're starting to see more members of Congress not just say you should get vaccinated, some of them like Steve Scalise finally saying now's the time to get vaccinated. So yes, I think you want to lift those voices out and know that those are the messengers. Dr. Gupta also talked about your local pharmacist. There's local messengers and there's national messengers. You just need to surround this. But I thought the speech was pretty remarkable because it was very plain, not a lot of spin on the ball, very urgent. I think that's what was needed. And I think what was interesting is he spoke almost as much to the vaccinated as to the unvaccinated.
Yes.
Understanding the frustration people have out there and understanding why we need to do the things we need to do. I thought that was very, very important to acknowledge that. I was also very glad to see him really speak to the toll that this is taking now on our public health professionals who've gone through wave after wave of this and in some places of the country are right back to where we were in the beginning. So I thought it was effective. But I do think you have to paint the picture, which is we can get to the other side of this. And there's a lot of things that governments can do, a lot of things the businesses can do, and ultimately that's very important. But this is about individuals kind of bellying up to the bar here and doing the right thing. And that's what's going to be required. But I think it's going to be really, really important. I thought what the NFL did was really, really important. I think that gave permission structure to hopefully other sports leagues, but also other businesses. Well, the NFL can do this. We can do this. And, you know, hopefully you see just today, it seemed like every 15 minutes, another company was saying they were going to mandate vaccinations. So hopefully we'll see that trend continue over the coming days.
Jonathan Lemire, Dr. Bing Gupta, David Plouffe, who sat down probably an hour and a half ago. They're still with us. So generous with your time. It's like the Hotel California. You can check out, but you can never leave. We're grateful to all of you for not leaving us. When we return, we are learning much, much more about the lengths to which the disgraced, twice impeached ex-president went to try to get his Justice Department to support his false claims of voter fraud and to actively work to overturn the 2020 election result. We will have that brand new reporting from the Washington Post and more analysis on that after the break. Plus, we'll talk to one of the Texas Democratic lawmakers who testified on Capitol Hill today about the Republican war on the right to vote and what the federal government should do to protect it. Also, new developments in the January 6th investigation, including some jailhouse trouble for one of the most visible rioters. Then the White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
I can't imagine a more critical question. Did you have conversations prior to January 6th with the President of the United States urging you to question or overturn or challenge the election results of 2020? It's a simple question. And by the way, no executive privilege has been invoked prior to this hearing and your testimony. And you've known you were coming here for over a month.
Congressman, respectfully, I understand your interest in the issue, and I've tried to be as forthcoming as I can with regard to the facts at the Department of Justice. When you ask me about communications with the president, I, as a lawyer, don't get to make the decision on whether I can reveal private conversations on that. Other people make that decision.
That was then, but now we are getting a whole lot closer to learning the answer to the question posed by House Democrat Jerry Connolly back in May, thanks to new reporting by The Washington Post, as well as a move by the DOJ that clears the way for Congress to get to the bottom of the ex-president's intense campaign to pressure the Justice Department into supporting his attempts and aiding with them to overturn the 2020 election. Washington Post is reporting today that at the end of last year, at the peak of the pressure campaign on elected officials all across this country over certification, Trump called Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen nearly every day in which, quote, Trump raised various allegations he had heard about and asked what the Justice Department was doing about the issue. The Post also reporting on the DOJ's decision to remove a crucial roadblock facing congressional investigators who are looking into the final days of the Trump presidency. Of this, they write, quote, the Justice Department recently notified Rosen, Donahue, and others who were serving there during the end of Trump's presidency that the agency would not seek to invoke executive privilege if they are asked about their contacts with the president during that period. Joining our conversation, Harry Lipman, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General, former U.S. Attorney. Also joining us, Mike Schmidt, New York Times Washington correspondent and an MSNBC national security contributor, and former Congresswoman Donna Edwards, Washington Post contributing columnist, as well as an MSNBC contributor. Harry Lipman, could this be sort of a dam-breaking moment in terms of beginning to understand exactly what pressure was exerted on DOJ and what they did about it?
It really could. So you've heard what Rosen was going to say, and there was this playbook established from the impeachments, Nicole, that Trump could have tried to exercise. Bring a crazy constitutional claim, wait 2 years for the courts to resolve, repeat. But the law is clear. It's the current executive branch who gets to decide if there's executive privilege. They've decided there isn't. Rosen cannot invoke it. Even if Trump tries to go to court and nobody can stop him from doing that, the judges should say, hey, there's no executive privilege here. Moreover, you don't have standing to be here. This is a matter of between the current Department of Justice and Rosen. They've told him to start talking. They've told him he can't invoke it. And we have the reporting that you've just mentioned that it was a daily harangue, every single conversation improper between Trump and Rosen. That would be exactly the kind of information we haven't had to date. And it would be a wealth of, I think, damning testimony about what Trump was doing between the election and January 6th.
Donna Edwards, let me read you a little bit more about what could, if Harry's analysis sort of holds and rules the day, strengthen Congress's hand. The Justice Department letter noted that even former officials are obligated to protect non-public information they learned in the course of their work, and that they generally do not allow former officials to disclose documents relating to such internal deliberations. However, the letter continues, the extraordinary events in this matter constitute exceptional circumstances warranting an accommodation to Congress in this case, including lawmakers' efforts to determine, quote, whether former President Trump sought to cause the department to use its law enforcement and litigation authorities to advance his personal political interests with respect to the results of the 2020 presidential election. We know from this reporting, Donna, as well as reporting that Mike and his colleagues have done, that that effort predates Election Day. I mean, this Justice Department started to look at issues around ballots and the election even ahead of whatever it was, November 6th. So my question to you is, what should the scope be in terms of what Congress wants to get its hands on? Shouldn't it go beyond Rosen and to really understand what Barr did as well?
Well, I think that, you know, we know from the former Attorney General Barr that there was pressure being put on him, even as he was stepping down as the Attorney General. And that Rosen, you know, apparently, you know, we know that Rosen was anything but forthcoming when he was in front of the committee. And so I think that the Select Committee has said very clearly that they are looking at the before, during, and after January 6th. And if there are notes, information, testimony, phone calls that are related under the former Attorney General Barr, then I would expect that that would be part of the before that that the committee would be able to look at. And I'm glad that this Justice Department is not going to stand in the way, because we know that January 6th was extraordinary, and it calls on a different way of looking at executive privilege in this particular instance, because it was about potentially overturning an election, going at our constitutional process. So I think there's a lot more to learn here. And it seems that the committee is going to get a hand at being able to get the documents and the testimony they need to put the pieces together.
Mike, can you speak to sort of your body of reporting of, and let me read the language of this letter again. What they have authorized is Congress, including lawmakers, more latitude to determine whether former President Trump sought to cause the Department of Justice to use its law enforcement and litigation authorities to advance his personal political interests with respect to the results of the 2020 presidential election. There's been reporting about U.S. attorneys in Georgia being pushed out or resigning. There's been a lot of news reporting about what was happening. But what does this really unlock for Congress, which at most turns has been stymied from this kind of access?
I mean, in some ways, this is all a bit ridiculous, because the president said all this stuff out loud. He said it all. He said it before the election, after he lost the election, in the period of time before it was certified, right before the certification, and then afterwards. And even in his statements more recently about what Barr did and didn't do and what the Justice Department didn't or didn't do. So all of this stuff is out there in the public. This is very similar to a lot of things that we have seen in the Trump era, where the president says something out loud, and then we as reporters go and we find out that he was saying and doing the same thing behind the scenes. In a normal presidency, the president wouldn't have said any of these things, and we'd have to go find out what actually happened in private. But these are things that he does not deny these. He says them all the time, and he still tries to put out statements about this. So this is not something that he has hid from. And while it is important to hear from the folks inside the Justice Department about how this was happening, a lot of stuff here we already know. We know what happened on January 6th. We know what he said when he was there in front of the crowd on the Mall.
Well, Harry, to Mike's point, I guess the sort of purpose then would be to understand how these requests were responded to inside the Justice Department. We know there was a transition. Bill Barr ultimately left after doing a whole bunch of Donald Trump's bidding before that point. Mr. Rosen, although unwilling to answer those questions, has turned over some documents to the Judiciary Committee investigating all of this activity. What is sort of the public interest in seeing it all and understanding just what was being demanded of not his DOJ, but the government's Justice Department?
I think it's still pretty big, Nicole. We know in broad strokes, but look, the report today in the Post still startles and gives real meat on the bones to the charges. And remember one other thing we now can find about the misadventure where Trump tried to install a lower person, Jeffrey Clark, head of the civil division, all of a sudden kick everybody out, make him the attorney general. Just how did that go down? How desperate was he? What was he trying to make the Department of Justice do? I think those details are more than sort of nuances. I think they're pretty vivid evidence of the, you know, of a lawless president trying to really browbeat his Department of Justice. I think that'll be an important part of the historical record, and they ought to be getting it, even if it won't be a surprise overall.
Mike, it also brings us back to the urgency and understanding the president's role on January 6th. If this was all stated by the president and all this frees up is the understanding of what happened at the Department of Justice, and if the same ruling sort of holds at other agencies, understanding how the government held or didn't, do you think this makes it more likely that this president's testimony will be sought by the January 6th committee?
I think they have to. I think they have no choice but to try and do that. And I can see that turning into this extended thing where it sort of elevates Trump again, and he gets to have a fight with Congress, with the Democrats in Congress, about his own testimony. I mean, that would play in some ways directly into his hands. In other ways, his testimony is essential to understanding who did he talk to on that day and what was really going on and what happened in the White House. Now, I can't imagine that the president would be fully candid when, you know, he would be talking about what he did on those days, because he has provided so many different, varying and accurate accounts about things in his presidency. But at the same time, I think if you're the committee and you're doing this investigation, you have to seek his testimony and the testimony of as many of these people as possible to have the legitimacy that you exhausted all the investigative avenues to get to the bottom of this.
We will all be watching. Harry Lipman, Mike Schmidt, Donna Edwards, thank you so much for joining us today. When we come back, the Texas Democratic lawmakers who fled their state to protest Republican efforts there to suppress the vote scored a couple of high-profile meetings today. We'll talk to one of them about that after a short break. Don't go anywhere.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win.
There are 154 prosecutions of voter fraud in the past 17 years in Texas. Out of 94 million votes cast, the likelihood of voter fraud in Texas is less than any one of us being struck by lightning.
That was Texas State Representative Diego Bernal, one of the Texas Democrats who testified today in front of Congress about the danger of his state's Republican-backed voting restriction law. The delegation of Texas Democrats has been in Washington for weeks now after fleeing their state to postpone a vote passing the restrictive bill and to push Congress to act on federal voting rights legislation. Joining our conversation, one of the three Texas lawmakers who testified on the Hill today, Texas State Representative Diego Bernal. Tell us more about your message to Congress, other than the very important message we should all start with, that massive voting fraud or even systemic voting fraud is not a thing.
Right. No, I appreciate that. And thanks for having me. My primary message today was to actually focus on the substance of the bill. I think that we get into moments where both sides are using platitudes. And I wanted people to focus on the four corners of the bill. It's 47 pages. And I took them through a small corner of it to demonstrate how it would affect a voter in their everyday voting activity, to show how harmful it was. And what was interesting about that was afterwards, people reverted the platitudes. They didn't really want to engage on the substance of the bill. And the few times they did, they got corrected. So, you know, in Texas, we're not just leaving to make a statement. We didn't leave just to raise our profile. There's really a bad bill that is in front of the House and the Texas Senate. And our duty here is not only to kill it, but to get DC, to get Congress and the Senate to help us out. And so I wanted to talk about the bill itself. And I think that we did a decent job of that today.
I feel you on the platitudes, and even people with a stated commitment to the mission sometimes regurgitate them. So go ahead and just go through that exercise here. Go through the damage it does to a voter in Texas.
Well, I'll give you a small taste of it. So what the bill would allow is for partisan poll watchers to have free range over the polling place. They could get close enough to observe and hear voting activity. They could leer over you as you vote. Another part of that is that the law itself says that they can break criminal law and election law, and the election judge can't remove them from the polling place. They're allowed to stay there. They can only get a warning, and only after the second warning, if the election judge sees it themselves, can they be removed. If everyone in the polling place sees that violation, but the election judge didn't, that person gets to stay. Only if the election judge sees the second one can they remove it. It's a free felony. It's two-strike immunity. There is nowhere else in the code anywhere in any state that allows for someone to break the law and not be removed. The point I made there was the manager at Target has more power to protect their store than an election judge in Texas would have to protect voters in the polling place. That's one example.
Have you had any conversations with anyone in Washington that lead you to believe that there is frantic activity around voting rights legislation?
We do get that impression. Whether or not it fits our particular timeline, who knows? But even yesterday, there was news that there's some movement, there's another version or iteration of a bill that may help us, that may help all of Texas and the United States. There's certainly activity happening. Whether or not it meets the deadline or it can gather enough support is something else. But no one is just sitting still doing nothing. In fact, I think that one of the things we have accomplished is we've forced the issue, and people in DC really are working to get something done now. What it is, I don't know. But I also think we're pretty open to seeing what they have to offer. And we'll take just about anything to get things better than where we are right now. Anything that raises the bottom floor, we will take. It's a good start, and I think that we have to keep pushing on that.
Representative Jasmine Crockett said that while she likes what's been proposed, she doesn't need the whole thing. She needs an inch. Are you confident that you will get an inch, that you will get something in the form of federal voting rights legislation? And if you don't, can you explain what will happen in Texas?
Well, that's sort of two really interesting questions. The first answer is yes, I do think we will. Whether or not it happens in time is the other question. And that's what remains to be seen. And if I'm being honest, that's also what makes me nervous. I think that it can happen in time if people really commit to making it happen. Because to your point, what will happen in Texas is HB 3 will most likely pass. And HB 3 is one of the most draconian voter suppression bills that we've seen in the country. Look, historically, voter suppression bills either add more procedures to vote, they add more requirements to vote, or they create new ways for votes to get kicked off or discounted. HB 3 does all three. So That's what will happen in Texas in a variety of different ways, some overt, some subtle. But the only way that we're going to get away from that is if DC, if the federal government steps in and raises the bottom floor. And whether that's an inch or a foot, we'll take anything at this point.
Can you just, this is the best articulation I've heard of what these laws do, 389 of them racing through 48 states. Can you just say that once again, the three things they do and the fact that in Texas they do all three?
So historically, voter suppression bills throughout history, they either add procedures to vote, they add requirements to vote, or they create new avenues for votes to get kicked off. And this one does all three. It's those three things. You can always find more, but that's something they all have in common. Usually it's one of those things. This bill and the Senate version do all three.
I thank you for your clarity. I thank you for your optimism that there is frantic activity that we just don't see. And I would ask you to keep coming back, keep us informed. Texas State Representative Diego Bernal, thank you so much for spending some time with us. When we come back, lots of new developments in the Capitol riot investigation, including an interview with one of the more notorious of the January 6th insurrectionists. That story's next.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
As congressional investigators surge ahead in a quest to uncover who was ultimately responsible for the insurrection on January 6th, prosecutors are still carrying out their investigation into those responsible for carrying out at the Capitol. On that topic, let's bring in NBC's Washington's investigative reporter Scott McFarlane and Olivia Troy, a former top aide to Vice President Mike Pence, now director of the Republican Accountability Project. Scott, I first have to apologize. I called you Seth yesterday, Seth McFarlane, who, when I tweeted to you to thank you, I sometimes have
to
make sure
I
sure you do. Scott McFarlane, take us through the latest.
So in the last 72 hours, we've seen a quick succession of plea agreements from lower level defendants, those not accused of damage or assault, what one former federal prosecutor calls the low rung defendants. If history is any guide, there'll be little, if any, prison time for those defendants. The road's kind of ending there. But for the higher tier defendants, there is a long road ahead. Right now, they're litigating whether to be held in jail pre-trial, which brings us to Richard Barnett. He's the man accused of putting his feet on Nancy Pelosi's office suite desk and taking her mail and leaving a vulgar note. He spoke with me, didn't want to talk about his case. I pressed him, but he wouldn't. But he revealed what life is like in jail for those defendants. He served a few months pre-trial. He says there is now a January 6th newsletter the defendants share and hand cell to cell. He says they are kept in a separate wing of the jail, and he did successfully challenge his pretrial detention. It says he doesn't expect sympathy, but says we shouldn't be surprised defendants are trying to get free from jail.
You can love me, you can hate me. You can love me and hate what I did. You can not like anything about me. But you have to put that aside, because this isn't about me. This is about our federal prison system in America and what they are doing to people, not just me, to everybody in there.
And Barnett's pleaded not guilty. Nicole, you'll recall he's accused of leaving that vulgar note for Nancy Pelosi. Well, this man accused of belligerence acknowledges he got in trouble in jail, mouthing off to the correctional officers, got himself put in solitary. He's back in court next month.
Yeah, Olivia, you watch what's going on outside jail, outside the courtroom, and there's almost a more elaborate and deeper permission structure for the crimes they committed on January 6th now than even then.
Yeah, it was striking to me as I watched that interview, and kudos for Scott for doing these interviews and really just bringing to light what is happening here, is just what a case of classic radicalization it is with this individual, right? I mean, he subscribed to a dogma. He subscribed to the dogma of Trumpism and the big lie. And that dogma lives on in elected officials still in office right now. And so in his eyes, he's done nothing wrong. And I think he's viewing himself as sort of the martyr. He is sticking up for his rights. And my concern is these individuals, should they walk free, I don't doubt that they will continue to remain involved, and they're inspiring others like them to continue in the cause. And I think that's just goes to show that the lack of accountability thus far on the actions of that day and what led to that day, that's really the driving force behind all of this. And these people are, you know, doing their, you know, their time, they're doing their court hearings, and they will be held accountable. But there's a whole population out there who is part of this entire thing that also needs to be held accountable.
And, you know, Scott, I know you've reported for us that this has come up from some of the judges who have seen these defendants, that the repeating of the big lie. You had one of the most outrageous and galling descriptions of January 6th, a description of it as a normal tourist day, repeated in a line of questioning from Congressman Jamie Raskin this week. Is that still figuring into the calculations being made by judges?
It sure is. In fact, just a few moments ago, this came up. Alex Harkrider is a defendant who is trying to get his release conditions loosened, wants a little more latitude while awaiting trial. A judge, you'll recall a few weeks ago, says no. Donald Trump is still perpetuating this lie or indicating he might come back in August, and that's too dangerous. We're not going to loosen your restrictions while that's going on. A few moments ago, Harkrider kicked back, said, please loosen my restrictions. Don't let me be, quote, guilty by association with what somebody else is saying, with what the former president is saying. It's still really relevant, Nicole. What Donald Trump says continues to complicate matters for these defendants accused of being part of the insurrection.
Well, and Olivia, you used the right word. It is sort of the classic radicalization and the conduct of extremists who Donald Trump has left them to rot in jail. I mean, he's still saying things that make it much more difficult for any of them to get out pending their trials. And he is not interested in any of their plights. There were no pardons considered for people that in his speeches to his rally crowds, he describes in glowing terms.
That's exactly it. And, you know, what we saw this week during the January 6th Select Committee hearing and watching those officers describe exactly what they faced in that mob, let us not forget these individuals were in that mob. They are part of that movement that was there that day. They led the charge that day. And so I think that, you know, what's happening here, there's this narrative out there, and it is encouraging this, and it is not going away anytime soon as long as people continue to behave in the way they did. And we saw it be so disparaging on these officers this week, on other networks that spoke so poorly of them just for telling the truth and giving their account of what happened. And I think this is fundamentally a movement that's going to continue, and we're going to see this happening with defendants.
Scott, you mentioned a newsletter. Do they sort of report to one another how they're being defended on news networks like Fox?
Yeah, I mean, they're updating each other on lots of things, on relatives' birthdays, on their medical conditions and injuries, and on how they think things are playing out in the court of public opinion. But let me give you one more scoop. They showed Tuesday's hearing in the local jail in Purgatory, Utah. The staff put it on for the inmates to watch. One of the inmates is Landon Copeland, one of the January 6th defendants locked up awaiting transfer to D.C. And Copeland tells me he watched and was struck by what he saw.
Struck in what way? Did he feel bad?
He thought the members of Congress, in his words, asked good questions, asked relevant questions, but he thought the officers were going too far. Of course, this is a defendant accused of assaulting police that day with a particularly unique and biased opinion.
Get the best of MSNBC all in one place every day, each morning in your inbox with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Understand today's news. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
Unbelievable. NBC Washington's Scott McFarland, thank you for staying on this story. Olivia Troy, thank you for spending some time with us. We will be back after a short break. Don't go anywhere. All right, a quick spoiler warning for any of you hoping to watch the Olympic gymnastics all-around competition tonight and not know what's going to happen, okay? You had your second. In case you've already seen the good news, we're bursting with it. This morning, 18-year-old Suni Lee became the first Asian-American woman ever to win gold for Team USA in that event. She grew up practicing on a family-built wooden beam that her dad built her in her backyard. So there was special focus on her family during competition. And when she won, for your enjoyment, here's how they reacted the moment it happened.
There's a little bit of bonus in the difficulty score.
Another big release sequence right here. Now back up. That was flawless.
Just that it's
so
not.
If you didn't see it last night, go watch the profile on her whole family. It's so beautiful. A little bit of joy in these ridiculous times we live in. Thank you for letting us into your homes during these extraordinary times. We're grateful.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.